I'm going to try to list the major movies, the important movies on my guest today's resume. It's impossible. So let me just give you a few that he's worked on. Raiders of the Lost Ark, Star Trek the Motion Picture, Star Trek the Voyage Home, Gremlins, 48 Hours, Poltergeist, The Burbs, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, The Lion King, Cool Runnings, Space Jam, The Fifth Element, and who could forget Mad Max Fury Road, for which he won an Academy Award, Blade Runner 2049, Coming Soon, Dune. That's just a few of the projects Mark Mangini has been the supervising sound editor on, and he has stories to tell. I don't want to take up a lot of time with an intro because there's so much about this interview that I loved, and Mark is amazing. So let's just get right to it. You should listen to Mark because Mark has worked on so many great projects. Here we go. Thanks so much for doing this.
Well,
I'm glad to have you.
I hope it's worth your while. That's all I have to say.
Oh, it absolutely is. Without a doubt. I hope it's worth yours.
I hope we get a chance to say some fun things about sound, because it's important to me to proselytize a little bit and preach the importance of sound in cinema.
Yeah. Well, that's why you're here. You've had a long and incredible career in the sound department on feature films, as a sound editor, supervising sound editor. But I want to go back before we talk about the recent stuff and some of your like guiding philosophy. God, we spent a lot of time on this podcast and on No Film School in general talking about picture. We don't spend nearly enough time talking about sound, so it's always exciting.
Great.
But I want to go back to the beginning for you and talk about what was your sort of inspiration to pursue a career in this business, and maybe even specifically in this part of this business?
Well, the inspiration in the business in general was that I was a filmmaker, stop motion and hand-drawn animation filmmaker as a kid. And this goes back to the days when there was still film and my dad gave me an 8mm home movie camera, and I loved doing stop motion and hand-drawn and pencil-colored animation. And I knew from very early on that I wanted to have a career in cinema of some kind, and yet, maybe we'll repeat this a number of times, but I didn't go to film school. I simply dropped out of college where I was studying foreign languages. I was going to be a translator. I wanted to be a translator for the UN as well, because I realized watching the Oscar telecast in 1974 that the movies were my true first love, and I just threw everything inside of a car and in my car, and I drove to LA like many kids from the East Coast do. We make the West Coast sojourn. So I ended up in LA with only raw desire, wanting to do something in the movie business.
So some of the first gigs were in animation. Is that happenstance, or was that because you were still pursuing?
It's happenstance, and when I moved to Los Angeles, I moved into the guest house of a friend of my dad's, and he asked me one day, how's the job hunting going? And it wasn't going. And he said, what do you love to do? And I said, well, when I was a kid, I used to make cartoons on my own. So he took it upon, he was fairly well connected. He took it upon himself to get me an interview at Hanna-Barbera Studios as an animator. And that caused me no amount of anxiety going into that interview because I didn't really have anything to show. I was more of a filmmaker than I was an artist. But as fate would have it, the vice president of Hanna-Barbera liked me. And 4 weeks later, he found an opening in the sound department. And that's where fate steps in and puts me in the sound department, the sound editing department and picture editing department of Hanna-Barbera Studios, the very well-known Saturday morning fair production entity that made the great things like the Flintstones and Huckleberry yeah. Hound and, you know, Scooby-Doo. And I worked on all of those.
Yeah. And so, and you did, you were the sound effects editor. How quickly did you take to it, and did it like call to you? Like, what was your relationship to that? Like sound, like, I mean, you're still doing it. So, like, and, right. and having gone from watching that 1974 yeah. Oscars to being now yeah. an Oscar winner. Like, so what, let's talk about the steps, like what you're thrust into sound editing, but something about it spoke to you.
What I didn't complete in the journey from Boston to LA was this, other notion that I'd been playing guitar all my life as also a songwriter and playing in bands. And I had this backup idea that if movies didn't work out, I'd just stay in LA and start a band and try to make that work. So I'd always had a really good ear because of my musical training as a guitarist. And I think that just sort of everything connected. It was cartoons, which I loved, and sound, which I loved, and music, which I loved, and all of those skills clicked into making me a pretty well-suited, I don't know, candidate for sound design, because sound design ultimately allows me to leverage all those musical abilities of thinking in terms of tempo, timbre, rhythm, tone, voicing, structure. Sound design has all those things that I could bring from my experience as a musician and as a songwriter. And I would argue, and maybe we'll talk about this more in detail later, that there is no difference between being a composer of a film score and the composer of a film sound design. We bring the exact same skill set to the jobs that we do.
What is a sound supervising editor? Like, that's the credit you have most of the time. What? How right. do you break it down as a role and as a position?
The supervising sound editor is the HOD, the head of department, as they say overseas. That's the person involved with, you know, and it's interchangeable ideally with sound designer or sound supervisor or
right.
Chef du son or any one of a number of other department head titles in other countries. It's simply the name of the person who the filmmaker relates to directly and shares their vision of sound and looks to them to implement it and bring it to life.
So it's the it's the department head for the movie's sound.
Yes, right? Exactly yeah. right. And, yes. and perhaps we need to define that. I mean, what often when people I'm introduced to people and they say, "Oh, he's the sound designer," they think that includes the music, and it's the one thing it actually excludes.
Yes, the first feature, I think, was the first feature you worked on, Star Trek: The Motion Picture.
You did your homework.
Well, it's yeah. not that hard with the internet these days, but I'm curious because, like, was that the jump? It sounds like yes.
Yeah, that was the first. It was the jump in that took a very, very brief small step before that. I had just seen Star Wars in 77 and I was still at Hanna-Barbera, and the light bulb went off. I mean, yeah. I've never been a particularly sort of career obsessed in human being. Like, I never had and still don't have grand designs for myself. So the fact that I was working at Hanna-Barbera and making decent money and living in a little shitty apartment in North Hollywood was just a good enough life for me. But then I saw Star Wars, and as it did for thousands or maybe millions of other people in entertainment, the light bulb went off and I thought, hey, I can do something even cooler than this. I could reach people in movie theaters. Yeah. And was that it?
Or was it also that, like, I mean, we talk about Star Wars a lot. It's a seminal moment in cinema, but the audio of that movie is a whole other galaxy. Again, pun intended, but like it creates an experience, right? And was it that it was in the theater, or was it just like, oh my God, what are they doing here? This is all so different, you know? Like, what hit you about it?
All of those things that you just said, it was connecting the dots of I create sounds and I really want to talk about cartoon animation sound because it's really seminal to our discussion.
Yeah.
But I made a connection between what I was doing, getting raw footage that arguably had no sync sound to it. It's animation. There's, you know, nothing existed in the real world. You have to fabricate the sound of everything.
Yes.
And then I made that connection to Star Wars, and I thought, well, if I can do this in cartoons, which just, you know, 10-year-old kids are watching, I can do something even more vital.
You make a great point, and it reminds me of something I've been thinking about a lot because I've been watching the old Looney Tunes with my son, who's almost six.
Oh, so great.
And as we watch them, I've watched them throughout my life, but something that keeps hitting me is how much the sound does.
Yeah.
They create emotional beats. They use music, but they use effect. Sometimes the laugh is more the sound than the visual.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking about it so much. And you just touched on it, where it's like all those cartoons depend on sound to create everything from the ground up. Right? It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist before you get your hands on it.
That's part of the joy of it, is that you control the horizontal and the vertical in a cartoon. And that's one of the reasons why later on in my career, I so loved the opportunity to work on Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin and The Lion King and a number of other animated films, because as sound designers, we're not encumbered by the production sound, which is often dirty and it's polluted with sounds that we don't want, and we don't fully control everything that we want to hear. Now, the point I wanted to make about animation sound is that, to me, it was the ideal training ground as a sound designer, because it teaches you very quickly to leverage metaphorical sound, which is to say, if somebody gets hit on the head, you don't hear, I don't know, could you hear that? I'm hitting my head with my hand. You know, there's nothing fun or funny or whimsical about that. What you want to hear is birds twittering or a frying pan clang. You know, it can be anything but, in fact, it should be anything but what you're actually seeing. And that, in its essence, is what sound design is all about. Thinking metaphorically about sound. You see something and you must pose the question, what could this sound like? Not what does it sound like?
That's So what I was trying to say about Looney Tunes from the other side, you just articulated beautifully from an actual how to do it standpoint, because that's exactly what I was noticing. It was like, oh, it never sounds like what it is. It sounds like something magical that it's supposed to be.
Or it speaks to another reality that causes you to think. So what's amazing to me is that because of the work of people like Jimmy McDonald and Treg Brown, who was the great sound designer for the Looney Tunes movies, now we almost can't escape this connection between being dizzy and hearing birds twitter, right? There's no reason why when you get hit on the head, you should hear birds twitter. But Treg made that delicious association.
Yes. Well, you have some Looney Tunes experience we'll get to as well, of course. But I just wanted, you know, one of the other examples of this, I could be wrong about this, but you also worked on Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I'm curious, because I remember recognizing at some point that when Indiana Jones punches people, it doesn't really sound like a punch. It almost sounds like a gun firing or something, or some kind of explosion. And I'm wondering, how quickly did you, because, you know, you worked on that as well as many other things we'll talk about, but that idea of connecting metaphor, or like you say, what it could sound like or should sound like, as opposed to what it does, when did you start incorporating that into live action that way?
Oh, immediately. The beauty of it is that my early universe in sound was one of everything is metaphor in cartoons. And so that was the only reality I understood. So when I walked into live action sound on Star Trek and then, you know, 149 movies more after that, it only seemed natural that that's exactly the way sound should be done, because you want to always be, A, as an artist, using your imagination, and B, allowing the audience to participate in that process of helping the imagination and telling stories at the same time. I think that's the best part of what I do, is that a sound can help tell a little bit of the story in a much more efficient way than often exposition in words can.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Sort of like give examples or illustration of places where you feel like you can economize some of the storytelling through the sound.
Sure. We'll make up a scene here. An individual walks into a room, but you're in close up, and the face doesn't give anything away. But what you hear, and I don't know, let me see if I have what. Oh, let's see. Oh, good. So what you hear is this. I'm going to try to belly up to the microphone. You're on somebody's face, or you could be in a medium shot, and that's what you hear. Now, what did you hear?
Keys?
Right. Keys jingling. What does that usually imply about someone if you're looking at them and they're jingling their keys?
They're going to unlock a door or open a door?
I would argue it says something much more subtle. It says they're nervous. People don't jiggle their keys. And it's an, I think it's an automatic association that we make when we hear that sound that speaks sentences of exposition about the mental state of that character. Especially, you know, if you see them and they're walking into a room for an interview, say.
Yes, if they're not in front of a door, then my theory doesn't work.
Sorry, I didn't set that up very carefully.
No, but I get it. I see what you're saying, that there's something distracted away from whatever they're doing. When you're doing these movies, like, you know, initially, like, you worked on Escape from New York, you worked on Star Trek the Motion Picture, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Poltergeist. These are some of the first ones, big ones. They're like high concept. They're in other worlds or they're in. So I feel like you're called upon to create entirely new sounds.
Yeah.
Try and create sounds that do what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, that's to use a word that isn't in the English language, the funnest part of the job. it's making, you know, look, how every kid in the world loves to make goofy noises. We do it with our mouths from the time we're infants, and I don't think we ever give it up making goofy, stupid noises with our mouths or making funny sound effects. And to get paid to imagine what all these unseen things might sound like is really a treat. It's the proverbial tabula rasa. It's the blank canvas. You're given a Star Trek or you're given a Blade Runner, and you see these things that a visual artist has dreamt up, and you're given sort of free rein to imagine what should or could that sound like. And that's just
you've worked with so many of the great directors and cinematographers, do they have ideas? Like, sound literacy is different, I think, filmmaking wise, obviously, than picture literacy.
Yeah.
Do you talk about, you know, you're working on a Star Trek movie and you're talking about things like, how does this weapon sound? Like, nobody knows. There's no right answer, right?
No.
Or Gremlins, or like, you know,
no.
or Mad Max,
right?
Where he wrote.
Like, yeah.
So, what is the conversation like with the other filmmakers where you're talking about, what does this world sound like?
I've been very fortunate to have worked with on a number of those movies with the Denis Villeneuve's and the George Millers and the Joe Dantes, to name but a few. These are individuals who deeply respect the art and craft of everyone that they hire. And it's very rare that they will get granular with me about what something should sound like. Which is not to say we don't go through a rigorous process of review and refinement, but
sure.
Almost to a man or woman, they allow me to use my first instincts as my first presentation because they trust me. I'm getting goosebumps now just thinking about that kind of trust and the honor.
That's so cool.
So it creates a huge amount of anxiety because rather than being able to grouse while I'm doing it, like, oh, they want it to sound like a foghorn, you know, and I'm trapped into a mold, I have, unfortunately, the universe available to me. So I have to start going through the process of looking at my blank canvas and wondering, do I start with blue or red? Should I use a camel hair brush or should I use a roller? You know, I have to start somewhere to define what it is that I want to create from scratch to present to them for the first time. And this is where the metaphorical thinking comes into play, because it's all those skills I learned in animation sound when you watch action and you think, okay, it shouldn't sound like what I'm seeing. It should sound like what it means. That those are the skills that I start to reemploy to get me in the universe of how to design something from scratch.
Just look at all the films you've done. There's so many unique instances of films where you had to find the way to combine, high concept is the word, but like you had to combine something new with something familiar. So within the oral world of Star Trek, you know, there's one of the movies you did happens to be the one where they actually come to present day.
Right.
So it's an example of having to combine like, oh, yeah. Star Trek sounds, but oh yeah, like San Francisco and
right.
the year it was made. Yeah. But also similarly, you know, Gremlins or The Burbs are movies where they combine some crazy element with something, hey, it's just the suburbs, or it's, you know, Gremlins, yeah. it's our world.
Yeah.
What is that? If that's something you've had to do repeatedly, how is that? You know, you say even when you're doing a regular sound, you make it, you try to find the meaning or the subtext yeah. or the metaphor.
Yeah.
But when you're trying to differentiate worlds, do you have like different sound worlds competing in the same movie telling the story?
No, the narrative, the story is everything. And I like to say that whether you're a sound designer or a director of photography or a costumer, our first goal is to simply tell the story. And there's really only one story that we're trying to tell. And the best sound is the one that honors that story as closely as possible. So everything has to live within that universe. That's your unifying concept.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Did that answer your question?
Yes, absolutely. No, it makes total sense to me. The idea that it's just that sometimes I could see that it becomes complicated to try and combine, you know, what this place sounds like in the spaceship, but it's also but then we're in the city, you know, but you're saying you take it moment by moment and serve the story as you go, whatever that is.
That it feels kind of simple to me, but maybe I've done it for so long, it isn't as simple as it appears. You know, George Miller, when I met George Miller on Mad Max, he presented me with his philosophy of filmmaking graphically represented by his pyramid. I'm trying to remember what specific name he gave. I'll call it the pyramid of importance. He said, in any given shot, and if imagine a pyramid, and at the top is the crown, and you bisect the pyramid with three or four lines. So there's something at the very top that's the cornerstone, and then below it are like two blocks, and then below that two blocks are three blocks. And he said, in any given shot, there's only one thing I want to draw the audience's attention to. And that's sort of our peak sound. And he said, inversely, visually, I only want the audience to be looking in one place. And he said, just below that are maybe two subservient sounds. But in any given granular moment, any given shot, we are going to tell the story with just one sound, because that's what the audience can't parse any more than that. There's so much information coming at them. So George used this pyramid representation to demonstrate how we try to focus the audience's attention moment to moment granularly with the things that we show and we hear.
That's so fascinating and educational, because one of the things that makes that movie excellent is that for everything going on in it, in a world of visual and auditory noise and content,
chaos,
it really tells you exactly what's, you never feel confused or lost. You know, it's very satisfying. On a basic level, when you're watching it, you experience that movie, you know where you're supposed to look and you know what you're supposed to experience.
Right.
And I think sometimes the blockbuster era there's sort of this disease of more. So much on the screen, right? Yeah. So much in your ear.
Yeah.
That's such a great unifying theory. Did that obviously resonated with you, I guess, because
hugely.
Tell me about the two supporting sounds. So what does that mean? You've got this one key sound and then these two supporting sounds. Like, how does that work in practice?
Let me get back to your very astute observation about how important that is. We like to joke in the sound community because poorly made movies don't know how to separate the wheat from the chaff. There's just too much going on. And we like to say the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences doesn't give an award for the most sound. They give the award for best sound. And one must remember that silence and reductiveness is a choice. And we are often confused as sound designers as well as costumers and editors. You know, everybody thinks that great film editing is about making more. The more edits you make, the better it must be. Or the more color, the more fabrics, or the more whatever, camera moves. It isn't about more. It's about right. It's about what is right for this specific moment. But to get back to your question, there's always one kind of what we call hero sound that is the focus of that shot. And Mad Max had something like 2,800 individual shots. So there's always at least one hero sound in every single moment of the movie. But of course, a hero sound like, the war rig. There's moments where you feature the sound of Furiosa's truck. But it doesn't live in a vacuum. It lives in a desert where you want to hear some wind sounds, and maybe there's some metal doors rattling, and there's some other subservient sounds of them moving around in the cab of the truck. So you have a hero sound, and that's what we're making sure we telegraph to the audience, but we always have to support it to create verisimilitude. Since that film, like many big blockbuster movies, is predominantly ADR, or automated dialogue replacement, or meaning we replace the dialogue. It's not the sync sound that was recorded when the film was captured. There's no ambiences. There's no reality to inform that shot. So we have to bring the actor or actress in to record their voices, and then we have to fill back in everything that you would have heard in meticulous detail. That starts with the hero sound. Top of the pyramid. Oh, I'm sorry. That's what George called his philosophy, top of the pyramid. And then there were these subservient sounds that had to build in the reality around the top of the pyramid.
I'm just smiling because it's such a beautiful unifying theme. I'm just thinking about it, like that idea of, I think filmmakers in general, and I don't blame them, it's easy to get lost in all the things you can do and all the things you can create.
Yeah.
And you're recording sound, and then you think you're layering in more sound, and you try to get as many cool things in your shot as possible, or whatever it is. But to be able to identify when you need nothingness or when you need blank, and to also be able to say, this is the key sound, but what makes this hero sound work is like, as you just illustrated, like a rusty door or the sound of the desert or whatever it is. It's why that movie works so well. But like so many of these movies, I'd like to hear about things like Dune and Blade Runner, which are completely different worlds you're creating. What is the experience like, I guess Dune and Blade Runner, you're working with Denny's again on both of those.
Yeah.
Do you have a sort of a shorthand there? How do you guys talk about creating those oral worlds?
One of the special things about my relationship with Denis on Blade Runner and with Dune is that he's very keenly aware of the special relationship between sound and music. And he recognizes that often they want to inhabit the same soundtrack, but they don't always inhabit in a friendly way. And he's very, very judicious about how he parses out where sound is carrying the top of the pyramid and where music is carrying the top of the pyramid. And yet he recognizes that often if we can disassociate the audience from their inner filmmaker and have them stop making mental notes about that was good music, that was good sound, and simply wondering, I don't know if that was music or sound. And
I love that.
That was his first cool. directive to Theo Green and I, my co-sound designer on Blade Runner 2049. He said, it was as simple as this in my first meeting with him. He said, I want you to compose with sound. And
now you must have loved that because that's like your whole philosophy.
It's mixing my musical skills and my sort of holistic approach to sound, because to me, there is no difference between a musical score and sound design. It's all composition work. We are both the composer and I using the exact same skill set, except that I would argue that my palette is far wider because I'm not limited to a 12-tone scale or traditional instruments. I can use anything, and including a dissonance and harmony. Not that a composer can't, but often, of course, the sound effects are the most dissonant part of the soundtrack of a movie.
You also have to use people's words, like human speaking.
There's something
fascinating about that to me too, in that, you know, we've talked sort of about the idea of connotative meaning and denotative meaning here. Mm-hmm. Like someone can say something, they can mean something different. So mm-hmm. when you're composing sound, there's the tone of your re-recorded dialogue. There's their tone, but there's what do the words mean?
Right.
But do the words and what they mean match up or not match up with what the rest of the world sounds like.
Right.
That's all fascinating.
I've created a term for that that I call nonverbal narration. That's what that sort of connotative sound design is you can say something about the story without ever using a word, and it can be not related to what you're seeing, or it could be sympathetic with what you're seeing. It all depends on where the filmmaker wants the story to go. You may be looking at a happy character, but you may be hearing frightening and anxiety-producing sounds. This is how we manipulate the audience through that back door, that subconscious mode that they're not really aware of, but more viscerally reacting to.
Streamlining the post-production video editing process just got a whole lot easier with Spider Checker Video. It's a handy, portable tool designed to leverage how video is processed when working with vector scopes, waveform monitors, and editing software. Included is a patent-pending color pattern card that generates an easy-to-understand pattern of hues at 2 saturation levels, so you can see how all colors between primary and secondary colors are being captured. The result? You start off with more accurate color at the start of your video shoots, so you have less color editing to do later. Now you can save $20 off the purchase price of Datacolor Spider Checker Video. Just visit datacolor.com/NFS and enter code NFS at checkout. Offer is valid in US and Canada through 6/30/24.
Yes, people are often more scared, or you can... I always tell people you can tell sometimes where the movie or the scene is going by what the sound is doing, not just by what the image is doing. The sound is giving you cues, right? But this is something that I'm so fascinated by. But when we talk a lot about screenwriting and the words on the page, and screenwriters often will have intent behind things, mm-hmm. they try to put it in the margins, so to speak, or in the description. But where do you, when you come to the other side of the process, right? There's that screenwriter at the beginning, then there's you and the composer at the other side.
Right.
Like, is that, what does that subtext or that intent make it? And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Are you ever looking for it? I mean, I guess what I'm asking, how do I ask this? It's a complicated question, but if you sense something there that wasn't necessarily in the script, or do you often find that the intent is followed through, the director brought it to you, and then you create it, subtext or meaning behind the obvious?
I like to believe that I'm a writer's best friend, in that if the intent was realized through great direction and acting, we simply support that even further with sound. And yet, not every scene in a film, no matter how well written or how well directed, comes off as intended. It's less common for a writer and I to communicate, although it happens, but much more common for a director to be very forthcoming and say, this scene didn't turn out exactly the way I wanted it. It's not as a happy, as soothing, as anxiety-riddled, as scary as I wanted it to be visually, what can we do with sound to help that? Or inversely, they may ask me to play against what the way the scene was written because they've realized that it supports the story in a very different way that no one had anticipated. Of course, a movie is this unknown beast. It's until it's birthed and it's got writing and directing and acting and cinematography and sound and music, you almost often don't know what you have until it's kind of all put together and you're all looking at it and realizing, oh, this is what we made. Maybe we better make some alterations over there so that they pay off further on down the line. And yes, so often that's... I am working against, I shouldn't say often, I have, and I find that to be a fun skill of trying to make a scene work better than maybe anyone intended by saying to the director, hey, what if we used sound this way? What would that say about this character or this moment in the movie?
So sometimes you all see that thing, that finished thing that you all worked on different parts of this body. You finally see the whole body.
Yeah.
And then you might say, you know what? The leg over here, I have a sound idea that can help it function better.
Exactly right.
And you come to the director and suggest something like that. That's fascinating. I don't know that enough people recognize that it's hard to see the whole thing until everybody's done with the pass.
I'm hoping when you see Dune, I'm quite proud of a narrative concept that I developed my first week on the film, my first meeting with Denis, that is not quite spoken to in the Herbert books. It's alluded to in the Herbert books, and I can't tell you any more than this, otherwise I'll have to kill you. I think even Herbert himself, when he sees what we've done with some voice work, would give us a bravo in terms of how it ties together a group of universes that we didn't think of quite in that way until we started applying ourselves to a specific sound problem in Dune.
That's so exciting. That makes me very excited to see it. That is a project where, you know, aside from the massiveness of the original words on the page of the book and Frank Herbert and the task of bringing it to life on so many levels, I'm just so curious what the process was like in creating the soundscape for that world. Did you go to some of the other, you know, the earlier film, look at that? Did you just talk about what the intent was behind some of the novel, creating new things entirely? Maybe you could just tell us, even how do you create a new sound? Do you combine effects like that exist to make something new? I mean, I've heard people talk about doing that before. What is that process like? I mean, you've worked on things like, you know, Dune, Blade Runner 2049, The Fifth Element, like a lot of sci-fi, a lot of like
four Star Trek stuff too.
Star Trek,
That's been a good genre for me. you know, that's a whole nother podcast.
Fair enough.
I would say this, that when I'm designing sound, let's just narrow the universe a little bit. If I'm making the sound of something we've never seen or heard before, that's one approach versus building sound for things we have seen and heard before, but I want to build in a unique and unusual way. So
that was your slapping the head example earlier, was it doesn't sound like that. It might sound like the pan or the birds.
Let's go back to basics for just a second. There's a great metaphor analogy in fine cooking that aptly describes how we sound designers need to approach our work. And that is this: the best meals are always made from the freshest ingredients. And what that means is, even though I may have a sound library full of sounds of, let's say, pick Dune, for example, I've got winds and I've got desert sounds, but I wanted the freshest, newest, most high fidelity one. So I nonetheless went out to Mojave and recorded the desert again, because I wanted the freshest, newest ingredients. And that's how any self-respecting sound designer would begin their process, which is a what I'll call the gathering mode. You watch the project in its entirety, and you make notes of what you need, either for things that you want fresh and new that no one has ever heard quite the same way before, and to identify unusual sound moment, sound occurrences that might be fodder for later manipulation when you're designing sounds for things you've never heard before. I'll give you an example. When I heard about Dune 2 years ago, I knew I wanted to rethink the way I've been doing spaceship sounds. Spaceships, you know, the kinds in science fiction movies aren't the same as, you know, space shuttles and Dragon X's. You know, those aren't the sounds we want for a futuristic movie. So I got to thinking about the metaphors that I could think of that would apply to a sound I wanted to record that I could manipulate later. And I remembered stumbling in my library upon the sound of a Tibetan longhorn that I loved, that I used in Blade Runner 2049 to great effect on some spaceships. So for this film, I was determined to record a tuba and make spaceships out of it. My youngest son and I happen to have a long-standing ritual, he's a composer, of buying each other new musical instruments every Christmas. So this past Christmas, he bought me a sousaphone, the world's biggest brass instrument, those giant marching band things with the huge bell that's like 5 feet across. And so I don't play sousaphone. I don't even have an embouchure. I can't even blow it. But I could blow it well enough to make a bunch of really deep, brassy kind of horn-like sounds that I would then later manipulate into the sounds of spaceships for Dune.
Wow.
So
that's so cool.
There's a quick example of how, you know, we're always looking for things in the world that make interesting noises that when we remove them from their context. Thank you. That was the word I've been looking for. And we recontextualize. That's a big part of what sound designers do is recontextualize. Here's the best example I can think of. If you love the Looney Tunes cartoons, the sound of the Tasmanian devil, the spinning Tasmanian devil, is the sound of a biplane's inertia starter. This hand crank device that makes a prop plane's engine start that goes and speeds up till it's spinning maniacally. It was the perfect recontextualization of a sound for something that we're seeing visually that resembles it. Because the Tasmanian devil's spinning around manically like the propeller on an airplane. That's the genius of Tregg Brown.
Yes. How crazy is it that we see sound that way? It's just fascinating to me. Like, we do see sound. When we hear something, there's a visual component before it's associated. So there's a match sometimes like that that you don't even realize exists until it happens.
Well, there's secret number two of great sound design is that we look for visual metaphors to point us towards the sonic sounds that might help represent them. So, for example, in Star Trek IV, there was this really important sound sequence where the bird of prey is crashing back through the clouds and it lands in San Francisco Bay. And it's a terrifying sequence where they've lost power. They're not going to pull out of this dive. And visually, the first thing I thought of were the World War II movies where I saw dogfights, and if an airplane got hit bad and it plummets into the drink, as they used to say, into the ocean, it would be accompanied by this very classic library sound we called strut whine. There was like, and anyone, no matter what age, you could be from 1 to 100, if you hear that sound, you know it's the sound of an airplane out of control. So I thought, that's the sound I need for the bird of prey crash landing in San Francisco Bay, because I added other sounds to it, but I knew the audience would immediately identify with out of control, gonna crash. And it adds that extra layer of impending danger.
That's so cool. Yeah, it's a cue. It's an auditory cue, right?
Yeah, it triggers subconscious things.
Yeah.
Somebody should do a psychological profile of what happens in the brain when we watch movies.
It's a great point, though, because that stuff has been done, and we've done it on No Film School about color and about visuals, but sound has all of that. And you say it's a secret. There is so much that's happening in our minds when we're experiencing the sound in a movie that we're not aware of. That's like a subconscious process, just as much as the eyes. I wanted to also bring up a couple other things.
I forget, I'm sorry, don't lose that thought. George Miller, when we finished Mad Max and he got up to thank everyone, part of this speech was of a quote that I've put in my blog. He said, quote, "Mad Max is a film we see with our ears." I just thought that was really profound. Good. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's great. What's your blog so we can tell people to check it out?
MarkMangini.com. It has my blog on it. It has photographs I've taken on all my crazy sound adventures. It's got, my resume and a bunch of
That sounds cool.
Also, a library for great reading with recommendations of great reading for sound.
When you go out, you say like for Dune, you were like, I need the best fresh ingredients, which is a great metaphor. Yeah. When you go out to get them, I imagine the stuff you take with you to record and to, you know, is different all the time because there's constantly evolving technology. But what is it nowadays? And do you ever, second part, do you ever say like, I want to record it on something old and different to distort it or create a different experience?
Boy, you do a lot of homework. I'm really impressed.
Well, thank you. If you run out of time and you're like, no, that's too much for me, I'm not answering.
I can talk about sound for days. Yes, you very, very appropriately recognized that every expedition, there's probably a newer recorder or microphone or methodology of recording that's come out that I want to present my sound in a newer, fresher way. So, for example, the last time I did a movie that took place in the desert and I got desert sounds, all I had was a stereo recorder and a stereo, meaning two microphones. And those are great recordings. But this is the age of immersive audio, Dolby Atmos and Oro and IMAX, and we need to immerse and surround and envelop the audience with sound. And I didn't feel as though, as good as those old recordings are, that they were enough for a modern movie, so it was time to go back out into the field with more microphones and more channels of recording and higher sample rate digital files and, you know, all the stuff that technology brings us over the years. We have to schlep out with Sherpas in the noonday sun. We had to carry, you know, gallons and gallons of water and sun protection and tents. And we literally hiked for 3 miles to get out to a quiet enough place to stage the recordings that we needed to stage to get the desert sounds that we were, and it was brutal. So we're always working on new ways of recording sound to get the freshest and perhaps the most immersive. But inversely, you've probably read that sometimes we like to revert to the old analog techniques to create either that anachronistic verisimilitude. We mm-hmm. want something to sound like from an old 50s television show. Mm-hmm. So we'll go research the old microphones and the old analog recorders and bring out reel-to-reel tape, which nobody uses anymore. But it's somewhat of a gimmick now, but it's a useful gimmick for certain things. And I'll give you the best example. Analog tape does something that is very similar or akin to what the human ear does. At a certain sound pressure level, your eardrums collapse and compress. And that's exactly what analog tape does. And so the way to get the best gunshot recordings, which are very high sound pressure levels, we often bring an analog tape-based recorder out into the field to capture it because the tape mimics the way we hear it. And when we hear it, something reproduced in a movie the way we think we hear it in real life, we ascribe it reality. And that gets to a bigger discussion of suspension of disbelief. The more we in sound or any other discipline of cinema can allow you to suspend disbelief, the more time you have to actually pay attention to the story. So if I can mimic what the ear is doing and make you sign off subconsciously, oh, that sounded like a gunshot. You don't have to think about it anymore.
Right. Whereas if it sounds like, you know, a slide whistle, then suddenly the story becomes secondary to that strange experience.
Yeah, that'd be a very strange experience.
Right. Right. But that, that's fascinating. I mean, that again, like, I think to speak to the power of the sound designer, that is the ability to determine the experience of the movie. Like, is it going to sound exactly like the real gunshot?
Right.
Or is it going to sound a little different for some reason?
Right. You know, that guns are a great example, because there is a really great example of this. I crassly purvey some of my sound library online through a great company called prosoundeffects.com. And they've produced a series of videos on how sound design works. And one of them was on gunshots. And I talk in depth about this. And so I encourage some of the listeners to go seek that out, only because in a simple shot of a person firing a gun, you can say 100 things about that character, depending on how high fidelity, low fidelity, loud, small, big, distant. There's 100 ways to develop that sound to say something about the character.
One of the most common things you'll hear about films or content people are creating, video, whatever, is that they didn't put enough into the sound. They put too much elsewhere. There are so many ways, having access to libraries, but more importantly, access to understanding what the choices mean and how they impact the experience of the story is just so useful. I mean, what kind of resources, what would you recommend somebody to do if they're, you know, they're making an indie feature, or how would you recommend they go about developing the sound for their film if they can't necessarily hire somebody who specializes in it, but they're going to end up supervising it or editing it themselves, or, you know, looking for audio?
Yeah, it all depends on the budget level, but I'll take a few things for granted. Or not for granted. The single most important aspect of your movie is the dialogue, and that deserves the most attention to financial resources and time. So it's the giveaway, the tell of an amateur production is bad production dialogue. It's often, you know, in the worst cases, the microphone was on the camera and they didn't even hire a boom person or spring for lavalier microphones and wireless transmitters and receivers. You know, if you're going to spend anywhere, it should be to get great production sound, and everything else will follow from there. If you don't do that, no amount of Mark Mangini-izing after the fact in post-production is going to help you. You're a dead duck.
Yeah. That is true. Assuming you get good production sound, you hire somebody on set, you have a mixer.
Yeah.
There's so much you can do, you know, obviously using a tool like Pro Tools, getting access to a library, recording the stuff on your own, like you said. Obviously they're not going to get the rigs you have to go out into the desert, but, you know, recording additional sound elements, like
that's the key. You know, the fresh ingredients thing is maybe the next most important thing to remember. Even if you don't have a library, you know, if it's not a science fiction film where you're designing everything, there's so much you can do. I can tell you shamefully that often I'm out with my little $70 two-channel Zoom recorder because it fits in my back pocket. I can't bring out my big rig all the time, so I always have some kind of handy-dandy little pocket recorder that records pretty well. And you can do an extraordinary job with some of these low-priced handheld recorders, capturing atmospheres and spot effects and, you know, sounds around the house to be manipulated into something later.
Is it your equivalent of the notepad in your back pocket? Do you ever, you come across a sound or an environment and you're like, I want to have a reference for this, or I may not use this, but I want to capture it and listen to it later?
Oh, no, I'm going further than that. Even these little $70 recorders are good enough to put in real movies, and even movies like Dune have sounds made on these little $100 recorders. They do a pretty darn good job, and it's a great way to get started, because, and then what it does is it's so convenient. it develops a habit of capturing constantly. And that's a habit every erstwhile sound designer should develop, which is record everything. You never know. My library has 607,000 sounds in it, individual sound files. It's one of the largest sound libraries in the world. And I'm still collecting to this today because I'm always saying to myself, I never know when I'm going to use this, but I bet you I will someday.
Yeah. Well, the fresh ingredients metaphor is so cool for that reason, because it's like, well, I may have it, but I may not have it the way it should be now, the way it sounds today. I mean, yeah. A car sounds a lot different now than it did 5 or 10 years ago. Like, you know, everything sounds different constantly. Yeah. It's all changing.
We're always recording. So
I usually end with something like this, a question like this, and I'm really curious your answer.
Okay.
you know, what advice would you give somebody today on getting started, finding their way into this industry? I mean, like you said at the beginning, you were inspired by, you know, wanting to make movies, making cartoons. If it's in sound or if it's just in this field in general, you've been in it a long time. You succeeded, worked with all the greats of multiple eras. You know, how would you advise? What have you observed for someone looking for a start?
What I've observed, and I can proudly say that I've followed this advice as well many times, is that passion and commitment will always be rewarded. Which is to say, if you think sound is your thing, you need to live and eat and breathe it every day. You should be every day making time in your day to listen to the world and think about why does the world sound the way it sounds. And then you should, after you've done a fair amount of that, and it should never stop, you should go out and start recording the world and building up a library, because then you have a facility for understanding the translation between what you thought you heard with your ears and how something reproduces over speakers after you bring it into your workstation or whatever you're working with. And then you have to start building sound whether you've been asked to or not. You have to practice this craft of listening, recording, editing, and designing constantly whether you have a project or not. And that means and I've had this brought to me, taking other sound designers' works, you know, rip something off of a DVD or a Blu-ray, strip out the sound that Mark Mangini made, and do your version of it. And I say that because I've had those exact things happen to me, and those were the people that impressed me the most, and those were the people, out of the thousands I interview from film schools, those are the ones I hired, because I knew they weren't hedging their bets about, oh, I'm not sure if I should be a producer. I think I like sound right now. Not going to cut it. You'll never get a job that way. This has to be what you've decided on. And then you have to live and breathe it and practice it every day, so that when you're in the crunch on a $200 million movie and an important director turns to you and says, this sound doesn't work, what should we do? You should not only have a series of scars and in your head from the mistakes you made trying to solve that problem, but you should also have an immediate series of reflexive reactions. Just like great athletes know the moves, they don't even have to think about them anymore, they just do them. You should have done these things 100 times before the critical situation presents itself and you have to do it on the spot.
That's great advice. I've never thought about that before. So you're saying, like, no, you know, having gone through the steps so many times that it's a knee jerk of like, oh, I know what the options are and I know what the best one is.
Well, let's put it this way. It's very valuable for it to be a knee jerk 90% of the time. None of us are geniuses. And I will say to a George Miller, or a Denis Villeneuve, you know, I'm not exactly sure what to do about this right now, but I'm going to work on it and get back to you. But a good portion of the time I'll say, oh, I know what to do. And, you know, in my mind's ear, I'm hearing something I did on a Star Trek or a Gremlins or a Scooby-Doo, because I remembered confronting that same exact challenge. Now I just have to apply the new circumstances to it.
And you think also that idea of of stripping the sound off of a picture entirely and building it again by yourself is like building those scars and those pieces of knowledge for the person, because maybe they weren't you and they weren't sitting with Leonard Nimoy on Star Trek, but they've redone it and now they have ideas and thoughts about how to redo it, right?
When you go through that process of creation, the bizarre, unexplained inspirations that come to you from, we don't know where they come from, surprise all of us. And you might think, you know what? I think I like this better than what Mark did. And here's, and that's beautiful. That's cool. And I love that. And I've seen that and experienced that.
Yeah.
And you know, this is all part of that whole 10,000 hours thing. You can't be an expert until you put in the time. And if you're just waiting for somebody to hire you to get the hours in, you're not going to progress like the person who's doing it every day because they're hungry, because it means something to them.
Well, you make it sound fun to do, which is also cool.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, your passion for doing it makes it sound like something people like. It's like, why wouldn't you want to put all the time in and make all, like, it sounds like a creative buffet creating the sound for a movie.
Yeah.
So it's exciting to think about it that way. And I honestly now I'm like more excited to see Dune than I was, because now I'm going to be thinking about some of these sound things.
Well, you know, part of it is my culture. I'm 100% Italian, so I'm convinced there's a little Geppetto in me, or there's a little Michelangelo in me that cannot. I take joy in what I've produced, whether anybody else enjoys it or not. But I also know the giddy sense of elation that I get when the light bulb went off in the creative process. I'm staring at the blank screen and ding, oh, that's what I want to do. And then 2 hours later, I'm done and I'm sweating and I play it back for myself and I think, oh, I can't wait to play this for the guys. That to me is you know, an indescribable joy of life. Whether it's a great game of golf or it's a sound design, anytime you can, you know, provide that joy for yourself, you know, you're alive.
Yeah, well, that's really well said. Thank you so much, Mark, for taking the time. It's been really fun.
Thanks for asking like really, really good questions. It's a joy.
I hope you enjoyed my interview with Mark Mangini. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Mark for coming on the podcast and for his insane contribution to the world of cinema sound. I learned a lot talking to him. I hope you learned a lot listening. It was, again, just a joy to chat film and film sound with somebody who's done it for as long and as well as Mark has. Check out everything going on with Sound Week on nofilmschool.com. We have tons of content related to sound editing, sound recording, production sound, room tone, the whole deal. And of course, all our filmmaking content at nofilmschool.com. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, like, rate, subscribe to the podcast, check out our other interviews, as well as our weekly podcast show where we cover the week in film and filmmaking news. Thanks so much for listening.